This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is 1:07 p.m. Monday, March 2nd, 2026 in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Coulomb, Representative Mears, Representative Prox, Representative Elam, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of this meeting. Thank you. I'd also like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today, in-house resources, we'll hear a project update from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. We have in the room Randy Ruaro, Executive Director of ADA, Charles Lampe, President of the Koktovik Inupiaq Corporation, and Emil Nadi and Fred Beifelt from the Ambler Access Project. Welcome to House Resources. I'd also like to note that we are joined by Representative Bynum. Mr. Ruaro, please come to the table and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Randy Ruaro, R-U-A-R-O. I'm the Executive Director for ADA, and it's a pleasure and an honor to be here today with the committee and with Mr. Lamp and the other testifiers who are going to talk about projects that ADA has, so the Ambler Project and the ANWR Project, and how those projects will benefit their communities. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Lamp.
Good morning, committee. Thank you, Co-Chair Burke and Co-Chair Dibert, for allowing me to present and represent my community of Koktovik, Alaska, before the House National Resources Committee today. Excuse my voice. I ended up getting sick last week, and I'm just finally getting over it, so excuse my raspy voice. My name is Charles Lampe, and I'm the current president of Koktovik Inupiaq Corporation, and I'm also a tribal member of the Native Village of Koktovik. I'm here to present our engagement with ADA. Thank you. Again, my name is Charles Lampe, and I'm representing Koktovik, my community, to discuss the importance of our homeland as they relate to oil and gas. Our people have occupied the coastal plain area for thousands of years, and this is undisputed based on cultural artifacts that have been found and dated from Barter Island and other important sites within the area. We ask that we be listened to as the original stewards of our homelands and as the only recognized occupants of the area known as the coastal plain of the Arctic Slope. Koktovik has been at the crossroads for our entire history. We live on Barter Island, which has that name on a map for a reason. It's because it was a seasonal trading point for the Inupiaq people and Inuit peoples between Alaska and Canada. The name goes back to 1826. The Koktovik Mute settled on the island in the early 1900s when the Gordon family moved to Barter from Barrow, now at Kajavik. This is an important backdrop and necessary for us to talk about more in light of everything that is going on now. In 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANCSCA, was passed and KIC was formed. The act was to allow for economic freedom for Alaska Natives throughout the state. However, 9 years later, we found ourselves enclosed within a federal system called the Alaska National Entrance Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, of 1980. And for the last 45 years, we have been struggling to regain economic freedoms promised under ANCSCA. Our community has been and continues to be aligned in support for oil and gas within the coastal plain. You will see pictures of the animals that we are dependent on for our subsistence culture, for our subsistence and cultural heritage. From our perspective, it is not a position of one or the other. We are familiar with oil and gas activities, and we understand the balance required to protect our homelands better than any outside party. We need a local economy that can provide opportunities and a future for our people. It is important that we have opportunities to realize economic freedoms at Banska while also protecting our natural environment, one that we have done so for generations, for thousands of years. That's one thing that really our community prides itself on is the stewardship that we've taken over our lands and animals over the air. We put that first because without that, we wouldn't have the ability to thrive and survive in such a harsh environment. But we've never moved from the environment because it's our homeland. It's where our families are born. It's where we lay our loved ones to rest. It's a place that we've called home for thousands and thousands of years, but it seems like we are overlooked many times as a people. Instead, people see animals and they see land. They forget that there's an actual indigenous community that has lived and survived off those lands and resources for thousands of years. And it should be our voices that should be elevated to the top on what should happen on our own homelands that will affect the ability for our community and our people to continue thriving and excelling in living on the slope like we have for thousands of years. We want to be partners with Ada and other lessees in finding that balance. We have been a part of the debate since the passage of Anelka. It was Anelka that tried to erase our people from the map, and that's still going on today, and it's a tragedy because it's not only going on in newspapers and other organizations, it's actually going on in state government and federal government where our people and our community are absolutely left out because we have a difference of opinion than the people who are making those statements or documents that are being put out. So it seems lately we've been having more interactions with more lawmakers and legislators and reporters that's able to get our voice out there because we're a small little village of 256 people. That's all we have. That's our families that have been living there for generations. And for us to be able to go against multinational companies and organizations, NGOs, and even the Gwich'in Steering Committee, which has a lot of backers from NGOs and rich philanthropists that help their cause. We have different communities and organizations at our local that help us try and get our voice out there, and we're really appreciative for that. And for our people, our organizations like Ada that reach out to smaller villages that they're going to be doing work in their regions to be able to reach out to the people that they're going to be affecting is it shows how much Ada actually interacts and cares about the communities and the state that they're doing businesses. That they're doing business in. So, less than 8% of the land within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was set aside under Section 1002 for oil and gas, yet nowhere were our people mentioned or was the area identified as being our homelands. We will not give up. We need contracts and the jobs that come with exploration. The operators of the leases will need subsistence representatives, polar bear guards, cultural resource experts. And this is what we can provide to help protect our subsistence at the same time. KIC is currently in discussions with Ada's prime contractor for permitting seismic program over the Ada lease on our homelands to the west of Barter Island. KIC has gone through this type of permitting starting in 2017 and was ready to receive our permit in 2021. However, the last administration refused to issue anything but a final unsigned draft. And the crazy thing about that is that they blamed the small community of Kaktovik and KIC and said that it was our fault for these permits not being moved through in a timely manner. See, that's something that we need more interactions with the leaders that are making these decisions like this hearing today is to be able to bring our voice to this, because I mean we're going to be the community that's mostly affected by this decision either way. And one thing that we were working with Ada with was to get the seismic program going. Seismic gets a bad rap. As a community that is protective of our region, we have been working with seismic operators since 2015 to learn about their impact to the tundra. And in these documents, you can show it shows the trails that the seismic program did. It shows the grid patterns of what they had to go across to get the data that they needed across the land. And it you can see the square patterns in the tundra. But if you look outside of that darkened box, that's later on where when the snow and ice is melted, you can't see any delineations. You can't see any surface disruptions or anything from this. And even if you're on ground level, you can't notice where they have been. I mean, the grass might be greener in some spots. But as you can see in the satellite image inset above taken on June 24th, 18, there's compressed snow remaining. The 3D grid where acquisition equipment ran the 400-meter grid, 1,312 feet following the program. However, and this is important to recognize, the outer boundary is the second satellite image area taken on August 28th after the tundra greened. You can trace the compressed snow in either direction, east or west, north or south, into the later image, and you do not see any effects on the tundra. And that's one of the misinformation that's being put out there is the damage that any work on the tundra done to do seismic would leave marks on the tundra and disturb the local wildlife. One thing that they don't also tell you is it's done during the winter time. If you go up there right now or any place on the slope during the winter, it's a completely different world than it is during the summertime where they show you all the pictures of the animals and the lands and the plants. Right now when they would be doing this type of work, it's completely cold and dark and barren and snow. So there might be a few caribou here and there. There might be a few foxes and then polar bear on the coast. But it doesn't affect the animals and the land like it's as adversely as it's portrayed. So there's a lot of false information out there about the way that seismic is collected.
Thank you, Mr. Lampe. We have a question or a comment from Representative Sather.
If I may, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lampe, appreciate your information. I look forward to the rest of it, too. But on slide 7, I'm not quite seeing the darkened area. Upper left-hand corner is dated 6/24/18. Can see that. That's mid-June. And the slide says the same area is shown in August 2018. I'm not sure. Is that the green area outside, or what should I look for to see?
You see the darkened square on the inside? That shows where it shows the lines of the beginning when the snow just was almost melted. And then you can see the lines. You see that square patterns. Yeah. That's where the equipment for the seismic program, that's where they tracked on. The outside of it, the lighter portion, the same tundra part, that shows later on when everything is completely melted. So it's just it's an overlay of contrast. So it shows that the lines aren't there later on once everything is melted. So that proves that there's not.
Yep. But just to clarify, so the green is August 2018.
Yes, the green.
That's what I want. Yep,
yes,
good.
Yes.
Thank
or
you
actually,
very much.
Let's see, is that the green is from June, the lighter green is from August.
Yep.
So this is due to the strict regularity, however, this is important to recognize the outer boundary second satellite, same taken on August 28, 2018, after the tundra greened. You can trace the compressed snow in either direction, north, south, east, or west, into the later image. You don't see any effects on the tundra. This is due to strict regulatory compliance of the seismic industry by the state of Alaska and development of the best available technology and industry. As we presented last year, our people have been active participants in developing sound environmental standards on the North Slope since discovery in Prudhoe Bay, and we pride ourselves on that, being able to be at the table and in discussions on what's going to happen in our region that's going to affect our people and our communities. That's one thing that has been passed down from generation to generation is our leaders are taught to look out for everyone, every community member, every child. It doesn't matter who they are. If they're a part of the community, we make sure that we look out for everyone, regardless. If we look at more recent developments, such as the Covo River Unit, CRU developed in 2000, the gravel footprint has shrunk significantly over time. The white boxes an outline of Washington, D.C., Arlington, and Alexandria for reference. So that entire section right there in the map, it shows an overlay of what Washington, D.C. and Arlington, Virginia would look like over what the development is going on in the Nuiqsut area, which considering the amount of development and oil extraction has taken place here, the amount of surface occupancy is such minute, and it doesn't even, you know, compared to what's going to happen in Anmore, where we take steps to make sure that our lands and animals are protected and that we have as small of a footprint as necessary. But, you know, we know in the future everything is going to be able to be cleaned up and put back to hopefully the pristine condition that it was before. The five gravel drill sites located within the CRU comprise approximately 1,000 acres to access between 700 and 900 million barrels of oil from five different reservoirs. By contrast, the PICA unit to the east of the CRU has current gravel footprint of 254 acres to recover approximately 700 million gross barrels after startup this year. Our observation of that interaction between oil infrastructure and Caribou are that Caribou like to raise gravel roads and pads and utilize them for gravel relief. It is not one or the other. The Caribou over time have become accustomed to using the gravel infrastructure for not just insect relief, but also against predation. The scientific term for this is they have a symbiotic relations with the industry. And that's another thing that keeps on being pushed, is that any oil development or any oil exploration is going to have an adverse effect on the Caribou or the population, which, you know, I worked in Dead Horse for a few years, and I, you know, I mean, with the Caribou population, they're not scared of going on pads, they're not scared of going on roads. In fact, like it says in this paper, they do it to get away from the mosquitoes, but then they also do it to get away from the natural predators in the area, and that helps protect the calves, it helps protect the Caribou. So them saying that the oil resource development is going to absolutely decimate the Caribou has been proven false so far, and then they're using that argument on the Anwar side, saying, look at the Caribou there now, they're being diminished, they're moving their migratory routes. There's no oil exploration or development in Anmoor on that coastal plain. The information that they're giving you about the Caribou shouldn't really be utilized in this, because there's no oil development or exploration inside the coastal plain, but they're using the numbers right now to show the migration routes and the diminishing numbers to go against oil development or resource development. So that should be later on. It should be a study later on after any exploration or development is done. The eastern boundary of Ada leases is almost exactly 30 miles from Point Thompson and infrastructure. I think I skipped over one part, so excuse me. On this map, the Ada leases are pink as to the west of the Porcupine Caribou herd calving area. Our Caribou do venture into Ada leases area. They do so after calving, when calves are stronger. As the predators of our lands and subsistence resources, we have advocated in the past to continue advocate to protect the calving areas for the Porcupine Caribou herd, as shown in the green area, the new BLM tract map that was published last month. The green area is depicted close to the same area that was dropped from the 2021 lease map and is in an area that is vital for calving survival. We believe that this, or a portion of this area on the eastern edge, needs to be dropped from the leasing. We do not feel that doing so would significantly reduce the interest in the next lease sale, because in our experience and observations of oil and gas bidders, they continue to use the string of pearls approach to leasing. This means they like to be within 30 miles or so of existing infrastructure, which in the area is Point Thompson. The eastern boundary of the Ada lease is almost exactly 30 miles from Point Thompson infrastructure. And one thing that I want to reiterate to this committee and to anyone that I ever talk to is that the important relationship that Inupiat people have with our land and our resources, including the caribou. The caribou is one of the big natural resources that we use not only during the winter and summer months, but we use it for barter with other communities. But, you know, it's there's nothing we would do to put that in danger to where it would adversely affect our ability to be able to continue to survive and thrive in our indigenous way of life on in the Arctic. That's something that we as Inupiat people, we're never going to shy away from. It doesn't matter if there's development or not development or, you know, any type of income coming in. We as Inupiat people, we live in the Arctic. It's part of our identity. It's who we are. It's you know, we're never going to move away from that. But we also realize in this day and age, we need an economic future to be able to provide opportunities for our communities and our people, not only for health and water and power, but for schooling and the ability to be for our younger generation to have the ability to stay at home in the villages, but still be able to learn and thrive in an outside world that is dominated by an economic-based society. So one thing we would definitely never put in jeopardy is our land and animals, because it identifies who we are as a people. We are asking that all participants recognize us as an integral part of the landscape. We are your consultants. We are your cultural experts. We are your environmental stewards and your partners. We can all do this right, but we need to be included in the process. We will continue to celebrate our past and our present and our future. We are inviting and want to include the operations into this collaboration. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and speak to this committee. I want to thank Ada for allowing us to come and represent our community. You know, we look forward to continuing the communications and the partnership with Ada. And, you know, I wish that every other organization was like Ada, to be able to, if they're doing work in a certain community or a certain region, that they have the respect to be able to go into those communities that they're going to be affecting adversely or in a good way, just to be able to go in and get the actual perspective from the community members and the people that are living in the regions that they're going to be affecting. Because that's one thing that I've noticed you don't really see a lot of. You see a lot of programs going on, but you don't see the people who implement those programs going into the communities and making sure that those programs are what those communities need and want and are going to be able to sustain those communities beneficially in the long-term basis. We see that with Ada. We didn't see that with any other organization coming to our community in our region, letting us know that they're planning on doing the, you know, lease purchases and you know, planning to work with our region and our community. And that's something that every department that you guys work with or any department that works under you or above you should strive for, is to be able to get that type of engagement, you know, and that's the first step, is being able to have open dialogue and communication with the people that you guys are making decisions for. Every decision you guys make here in Juneau affects someone on a personal level. You know, you could, I mean, it, your guys' job is so important that it's really important for you guys to get every view and every aspect of the decisions that you're making and, you know, make the right decision down the line. So I want to thank you again for this opportunity. And sorry about my voice again.
Clean up the CC. Are there any questions or comments before we move on to the... All right. Seeing and hearing none, thank you so much. And let the record reflect that we are joined by Representative Hall at 1:30. Mr. Ruraro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Randy Ruraro, RUARO, Executive Director for ADA. I want to thank Mr. Lampe for his comments. Very good to work with those folks. It's one of the most enjoyable parts of the job, frankly, is being able to work with the communities. I would start on slide 13, Madam Chair, and this slide shows the location of our leases in Anwar in the coastal plain. We're just to the right of Point Thompson, and we've got six leases, all awarded under 2017 Tax Act, which carried language with it from Congress that the Anwar Coastal Plain shall be developed for oil and gas. It didn't say may. The language was mandatory and said it shall be developed. And so we're going to continue to work with Cactovic and others to make sure we can develop those leases in the most responsible way. I would add that we did prevail in a court case challenge to our leases. District Court Judge Gleason ruled in favor of ADA that our leases have been wrongfully canceled. We have the leases back, and we're moving forward to develop a seismic program to prove up the oil reserves and gas reserves. We have done some work so far with some consultants and experts, geologists, and they're telling us that we have roughly 4 to 4.5 billion barrels of recoverable oil and 7 trillion cubic feet of recoverable gas on our leases. So a massive resource needs to be proven up, though, with the 3D seismic, and then we can advance from there.
We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Arrow, thank you for presenting to us. I'm looking at slide 13 again, looking at the map, and I always like to make sure we have a good legend so the information conveyed is intelligible. I'm sorry, ADA holds leases or has purchased leases, and if so, I believe so. And which are those? That's not all the numbered tracts, but just the blue, just the, you know, please help me understand which are which, please.
Sure. No, through legend. The chair, Representative Sadler, ADA's leases are in the dark blue.
And if you would follow up. And just a brief little background of how ADA came to obtain those leases, please.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act required the Department of Interior to hold several lease sales. At the first lease sale, ADA bid on several tracts and was the winning bidder on the leases that we still hold.
Sure. One more follow-up. Looking, and how long are those leases? Usually hold leases by production. What is the duration, the term of those leases, please?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the initial term is 10 years, but that term has been tolled by the litigation period when the leases were in question and canceled, so our lease term did not run. While the litigation was pending, the clock is running now.
You can, so my next question is going to be, when do they expire?
Through the chair, the leases with the clock restarting, leases would expire in 2035 unless oil and gas production has started or a case can be made that it's reasonably likely it will start in the near future.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Rivaro. So what are ADA's plans here? Is it just exploration? Are we getting into a state oil and gas business? I would like to flesh that out a little bit more.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Mears, ADA's plan is not to start a state oil and gas business. Our plan is to advance the 3D seismic, prove up the reserves, and at that point, with that imagery and clear technology and results that show the reservoir is there, oil and gas is there, we will reach out to potential partners that are in the business of developing oil and gas and look to form some sort of a joint venture with that entity to actually run and develop the leases.
Follow-up, Representative Mears?
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Arrow. So is this the first time the state has been involved in this type of exploration? Has it always been done private sector before, or are there other examples of the state doing exploration like this?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, I don't believe it's the first time. I think at one point NPRA was jointly explored by the state and federal government. On mineral leasing, obviously, DNR, Division of DGGS conducts its own research and findings. I'd have to look through the records to see what they've done on oil and gas, but they've certainly done a lot on minerals. And I think there's usually a budget item in the capital budget, for example, for rare earths mapping, critical minerals mapping, other things like that. So,
Thank you. Co-Chair Dibert?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Rara, through the chair. The map, so you have six, the blues, the six sections. What is the golden section next door to it? And on the blue section, is that where you're doing the 3D mapping now?
Through the chair, Representative Co-Chair Dibert, the golden section is lease lot 29, which is a contested ownership lease lot between the state and the federal government. It was bid on, it was awarded, but then the winning bidder turned it back. So it's available again in the next lease sale. It's highly prospective for oil and gas. It's right next to Point Thompson, right on the border. So we expect to see that lease lot offered in the next sale.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair.
Hold on, Representative Cox, she was following up.
Sorry.
Well, and then absolutely. And then I've got Sadler, and then, yeah. And, okay.
If they're mapping now.
Through the chair, my second question was, is this where you're 3D mapping currently or not yet?
Sure. Through the chair, Co-Chair Dibert, we are not conducting 3D seismic at this moment. We are preparing the permits for a 3D seismic program, and that 3D seismic will actually be not covering the entire area of our leases. It'll be centered almost in the center of lease lots 27, 26, and 31. So that's the most prospective targeted area that our geologists have advised us to perform 3D seismic on.
Thank you. I've got in the queue, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Actually, you've answered some of my question. I was going to ask you, Mr. Rowe, what 3D has been done, how much more has to come, and when. I don't know if you want to polish up any more information. And when do you think the 3D program will be completed and you can approach industry potential JV partners?
Sure.
In the future timeline, please.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. So we believe the 3D seismic program will be completed by the end of next winter and that it can be processed fairly quickly, potentially using an AI cutting-edge program. Previously, 2D seismic was shot over the entire coastal plain in 1987, I believe. So there is older 2D seismic, not nearly as accurate as the current 3D techniques.
Okay, and just if you would polish, so at the end of winter of 2027, so that'd be like December 2027?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's correct.
Right. And ADA's intention would be to have that information in hand once it's processed and made pretty and usable, then to begin to approach industry potential partners. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we'll be reaching out to some potential partners before then, but it'll really be the 3D seismic results that will confirm the resource that'll really make it attractive, I think, for new investors.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Prox?
Thank you. Through the chair, the seismic, so you're going to get the permits and everything's going to be completed if it goes as planned by the winter of 27. And are you just going to contract the work out to a seismic exploration company, or are they going to become a partner at this point? I'm wondering how you're managing the risk, if you will.
Through the chair, Representative Prax, we would at this point contract out to a 3D seismic company.
You have a follow-up, Representative Prax?
Yes, I guess so. Follow-up. Thank you. Through the chair, are you then being optimistic and starting to look for potential partners or investors after this work is complete? How much of a gap between that?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Prax, so with the work that ADA's had completed already, looking at adjacent state land well results, well logs, and other information about the 2D seismic that was shot in the 80s, everything we could find. We feel pretty confident that the resource is there. That's why we kind of reduced our 3D scope to a certain area. We would, you know, reach out now. We actually have a public report, public version of a report I can provide to the committee if members would like to see those results.
Follow up. So if you move forward past the seismic exploration, then there's a whole new permitting process that starts?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, I believe at this point our intent is to include an alternative in the work scope of permitting for actually drilling a one or two exploration wells.
We'll move on. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Took me a minute to spin my brain into what a potential business partnership would look like. And today is probably not the day to get into that, but I would definitely like to learn more about what the potential is, what those relationships would look like, if ADA currently has the statutory authority to enter those relationships, and what the return on the investment of the leases is. What's the business plan for a return to the state? So that's a little bit more than for just now, but I'd really like to take some time at some point to get into what that business structure looks like and if there's any additional authorities that ADA needs to do that.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, ADA's statutes are very broad in terms of its authority to enter into contracts, not only with private parties, but local entities, other state corporations. We really have a broad authority to enter into contracts to accomplish economic development and reduce unemployment. So I can get you the exact citations for those if that would be helpful. In terms of what the business structure is likely to look like, it will obviously be a structure where a different company than ADA or a different entity than ADA is the lead in developing the leases and producing oil and gas. Will be much more of a silent type partner.
And then follow up. Thank you, through the chairs. And then the final piece of that is what is the business plan that's showing a return to the state from this process? So ADA's out, you know, state investment for the leases. How do we get a return on that?
Sure. So, Madam Chair, we would negotiate a return on the sale of the oil and gas that's produced for ADA. Some percentage of that would come to ADA, and 25 to 50% of that income would then be shared with the state treasury through our dividend statute. The other revenue option is, if I can advance the slides, this slide sets out some of the revenue flows from development. These numbers are from the 2024 EIS that was created by the previous federal administration. And so these numbers are in millions. And so you can see significant North Slope borough property tax, state of Alaska royalties, and those are annual numbers. And so we're looking at roughly potentially as much as $2 billion a year in revenue to the state through royalties and taxes. And of course, 25 to 50% of those royalties will go to the permanent fund. So really significant returns in revenue potential to the state, not just through ADA, but through the current tax system.
Thought I was jumping ahead.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to kind of say for the record, I'm asking some particular questions, but I want to get in the record. I very much support ADA stepping up to help the state and the country out to do the kind of the scut work necessary for our state to realize and benefit from the intent of Congress in setting aside the 1002 area in Anilka. It's been decades, and it's been just as delayed. It takes a lot of slogging and hard work to get the data, to get the permits, to get the partners, and to get busy generating revenue for our state and national, and the jobs and everything, other benefit that comes from this kind of thing. I appreciate the chair for bringing this in front of us. And before we progress much further, I just want to say I really do, I'm very grateful to Ada for doing this work and hope you're successful.
Through the chair, thank you.
Seeing no further questions. Oh, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. So what I'm understanding right now is that ADA can move forward without any additional legislative approval or anything like that.
Through the chair, Representative Prax, the answer to that question is it depends. If we don't need bonding authority for $400 million or more dollars in a year, or we don't need bonding authority for $25 million or more in a year through the Economic Development Fund, then there is, I don't believe, a requirement for additional legislative authority. If we were to ask for funds, obviously that would have to run through a capital budget or something along that line, but we have the authority to enter into contracts with private parties now.
Okay, and yes, thank you. Just a request, I suppose, that we end up sort of getting involved, if nothing else, in the public relations part of this. So I would appreciate some additional information about the business plan and et cetera so that we can decide whether we get into building apartment buildings or drilling for oil. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Colon.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, thank you for being here. And I did want to just give a shout out to the efforts you've done to connect with communities where you do work. It's really, really important and sounds like it's very meaningful. So thank you for doing that. So I just had a simple question on the royalties in the chart. This is at the 50% rate. It's not the, because I think in 2030 it's supposed to increase, the royalties increase, but this is what it is now, not what it will become, because there will be more after that, right?
Through the chair, Representative Colom, you're correct. So okay. Congress just recently in the Reconciliation Act increased the state share of the royalties by 20%, so that number would increase.
Okay. By a lot.
Seems significant amount.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions, Mr. Raro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is pretty much the end of my comments on ANWR.
Okay.
If we could, Chair, could we take just a short couple-minute recess?
Sure. Brief at ease.
Apologies.
We are back on record in House Resources. Mr. Noddy, Mr. Beifelt, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Hello, my name is Fred Beifelt. I'm from the village of Hooslea on the Koyukuk River. Welcome. My name is Emil Noddy.
Emil. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and we appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee here. And it's been a while now that people in our village of Hooslea on the Koyukuk River, and also the villages on the Upper Kobuk, that we've noticed our life dramatically changing from a traditional lifestyle like we all hear about to where the game populations and the fish has really declined. And it's virtually impossible for us to exist as we did back in the day when we used to trap for a living and stuff like that. For one thing, there's no market, and another thing, there's nothing to trap. So we have had to transition from that quote-unquote traditional lifestyle. But although we still have to survive off the meat and whatever we can get from the land, we also have to have products from Western civilization. And so we've really had to transition to trying to figure out how we could make a living within our villages and not have to move to where our work is. And that's a huge problem that we've seen within, I think, probably about the last 20 years, maybe even longer, but definitely 20 years, we've seen a huge transition of our people from our villages that had to, because ever since we were young, our elders and our parents, they tell us, we want you guys to go to school and come back and help us. Because a lot of, the vast majority of them were, they didn't have education as we know it. And so they wanted us to have a chance to prosper and be successful. So that's why they encouraged us to go to school, go to college, folk ed, military, what have you. But the problem that we've seen from our villages is when, and my kids included, when we send them off to some form of higher education or whatever, and they were successful, got their degrees and their careers and everything, they never came back to us. And it's really made it difficult for our villages to move into Western civilization without that expertise that they left us and they moved into the urban centers, and so that's where they're at. And we've seen that more and more, to the point where it started really affecting our student enrollment in our schools. It's just devastating. And so for some time now, our local people, we've been talking about how can we reverse that out-migration. How can we get our people to come back to us, help us? And that's been a really tough question. All because we're rooted deeply in our indigenous culture and the area that we all live in, all of us. And we don't want to hurt the country or anything. But we also realize that we have to move into a modern era. Either that or we have to move completely from where our villages are and move to Fairbanks or Anchorage or wherever on the globe. So that's where some of my friends and I really started talking about how can we have economic development that'll sustain our communities? How can we get our young people that are highly educated to come back and help us? And that's been a really challenging question. And we had to do a lot of soul searching. And I think we came to the conclusion that we have to, because for a long time, since I was young, we were opposed to any kind of development of roads that'll hurt our villages in terms of more hunters coming in or what have you. And we were opposed to natural resource development at one time, too. But eventually we started seeing that natural resource development as like the Amber Mining District or along the Amber Access Project Corridor, the minerals that are there, those are opportunities for us to capitalize on how can we help our villages. We have to do something like that. And so we started talking about that, and we started working toward it. And I'll have to admit, it seems like there's more of my people that are opposed to this kind of stuff than who are in favor of it. But when you really take a long, hard look at it, the people that are opposed to anything that's going to help our villages are not living in our villages. They're the ones that we told go get a good education and come back and help us, and they didn't help us. And they moved to Fairbanks and Anchorage and where have you. But when we talk about the Ambler Road and the Ambler Mining District or natural resource development, they're the ones that are saying, no, that's not a good idea. And they do not help us in our villages. We're pretty much dying on the vine. I sit on our regional school board for close to 30 years, Yukon Koyukuk School District. And there's probably about 3 schools right now that are on the verge of closing. And there's other schools that the student enrollment is dramatically declining. And we're really concerned about that because, when the schools close, that pretty much, that community is done. We know that. So we're taking a hard look at it, and we're trying to bring our people back to our villages so our communities can prosper again. But we realize that we have to change our way of thinking in order for that to happen. We have to provide opportunities for our people to sustain themselves in our villages. And that's why we finally came around to starting to support natural resource development. But with that said, we want workforce development. We want jobs for our people. But not only that, we also want the business opportunities. Because we've seen for far too long that, like the pipeline, for instance, back in the day, our people went to work, they had a job for 2 or 3 years, and that was virtually it. We had no business opportunities, and then when the pipeline was done, everybody went home, and that was it. So very few of them entered the union and prospered, but the ones that did, they prospered, and now they're retired and all that. So this time around, what we're saying on the Koyukuk River, Huslia, Hughes, Allakaket, and Ambler, Chungnak, and Kobuk, Kayana, we're saying we also want business opportunities. We want a seat at the table where we could help our people not only with jobs, but we want the business opportunities so we can develop our local economy. Why couldn't we? Why couldn't we use provisions from tribal government where we could create a tribal corporation and truly exercise our sovereignty? I really believe this is going to happen. It ain't going to happen overnight. But I see my kids and I see my grandkids, our grandkids. I see a lot of potential there. And they're the ones that's going to make that transition. They're the ones that's going to find a true utopia. That's what I see for my indigenous people on the Koyukuk River. We have to try to do something. That's our only means of survival. Along with that, we're also thinking outside the box, and we're looking at creating a home rule borough. So we're tired. I sat on our school board for almost 30 years, and I'm tired of having my hand out. Why couldn't we control our destiny? Why couldn't we capture revenue for ourselves instead of having to ask for something all the time? And so we're looking at a home rule borough. How can we use the bonding capacity and capture revenue with whatever provisions it provides for us? Why couldn't we think like that? Why couldn't we use tribal government like a Section 17 corporation, like what they do in the Lower 48? Why couldn't we bring that back to our people on the Koyukuk River or wherever? It's thinking like this that's going to get us from the times that we're seeing that's getting harder and harder and harder. Every turn we make, they're telling us there's no more money, there's no more funding. Why couldn't we turn it around to where we start growing again? That's what me and my friends are saying. And deep in my heart, I know we can do it. I know we will do it. But we want to do it to our specifications as indigenous people or as Alaskans. We want to do it to where we have an equal footing along with anybody else in America or in the world as far as business is concerned. And we're truly committed to this. I think in the course of time, history is going to show that when we started looking at avenues like economic development and such, that was what really made the difference. And it's deep in my heart that we're going to achieve everything that we set out to do. It's been proven up on the North Slope. It's been proven in Northwest Arctic with the Home Rule Bureau. And I have no doubt in my mind that within the interior of Alaska, we can achieve the same thing. Gain equal footing with whoever is involved in decision making in our great state. And so we can have an equal play and we can pass the wealth on to our children and to future generations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Byfield. Looks like we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Byfield, I appreciate your heartfelt and thorough delineation of the situation that your region and your villages face, and I appreciate the soul-searching that they've gone through to realize that it's not abandoning culture, it's embracing change and preserving culture in the face of change. I'm curious, you spoke a little bit about the change in attitude towards resource development projects in general. How does that break down among the different age groups, the elders versus the young people versus the middle age? Can you give me any kind of sense of how people of different age groups feel about projects like Ambler or resource development in general?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, you know, it's ironic. I mean, my dad, my mom, and our elders, they're no longer here. But if they were here, they had such a totally different perspective. Their mind was open. They would have been open to the Ambler Road. And they were, my dad was in favor of natural resource development, mining. That's how he learned. He didn't know how to read or write. He was illiterate. He could sign Cube Eiffelton, and that was it. But they went to the Hog River Mine, and that's where they all learned how to be operators, mechanics, what have you. So that's why they were like that. And as times change, like I think it was started in the 60s, I noticed that our people's minds started closing up, like, and that's when we became opposed to any kind of new development or whatever. We were like that for, I mean, you heard about it, like, those are the hippie days or whatever, you know. But I think early 80s, that's when I started seeing a shift again back to we started thinking about how can we help ourselves. And before some of my prominent elders passed, they told me we really got messed up a long time ago when we were young. Everybody used to work. We all help each other out. We all hand and did everything. We didn't wait for nothing to come to us. And this guy told me, he said, now things really change. Now everybody is just waiting for something to come to them. They don't want to build their own house. They don't want to work. So that, and I think that's really what happened was that I don't know when it started, Roosevelt or whenever, but so, and now we're starting to see that change again where people are starting to say, we have to work. We have to go back to work. It's good for our attitude. People talk about high rates of suicide and depression and the mental depression and all that. We all know that it's good to work. It's good for us to work. And that's what we're trying to get our people, our kids to do again. But it's a difficult transition because if they go to work, then they lose their benefits or whatever. And that's really a big problem. But it's changing. And as we know, as what we've been seeing within the short term here, with declining in funding from federal government and what have you, hopefully we could find other avenues that will help us bring in more revenue to our communities.
Thank you very much for that heartfelt and enlightening. I know that when you look to the west, you can see the development that Red Dog has done and the benefits that's brought to that region. I think Ada is a good partner in trying to achieve the goals of your people. So appreciate you being here to speak on your community's behalf.
Thank you.
I've got first co-chair Dibert, then Representative Elam.
Good afternoon. Thank you through the co-chair to Mr. Beifelt, Anabasi, for sharing your story of your community today, just being in a rural community. So my question is, going back to mentioning of food and food for your community, subsistence, it's hard. You have to have a boat. You have to have a four-wheeler. Gas, the price of gas, I don't even know what that is out in Huslia or along the Koyukuk River. Can you tell us, like, just very briefly, the price of food? You said getting Western kind of food to your stores, just the general cost, so we have a good picture of your community. And maybe, like, down the road, a road could help with those costs. I don't know. Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Dibert, the cost of living is really high. In food, we're still able to get a lot of our natural food from the land, but it's really transitioned from the way it used to be. We used to get our groceries on a barge. So it would come in the fall time, a big order for all winter, and then next spring, another big load of groceries will come on the barge. And so that's what we had. And we've seen a lot of ups and downs. A lot of times we ran out of stuff. But nowadays it's totally different. It's Huslia, we get three flights a day, and that's how a lot of our groceries are coming in from Costco, Fred Meyer's, Safeway, wherever. So it's changed a lot like that. We have small grocery stores that help us out, but a lot of people are ordering from the urban area. The cost of living is really high, especially if you're not able to utilize a barge service. There's some from Huslia is not too bad. I think we're paying $6.25 a gallon, and that's cheap compared to you go to the next village up is Hughes. I think they're paying $10 a gallon, and then you go to Allakaket, and they're paying I would want to say $13 a gallon, and they only have 4,000 gallons of capacity. So they're having to fly fuel in every so often. You go over to the village of Ambler, and I'm pretty sure they're paying $18 a gallon for gas. And they have the same problem. They they have they don't have much bulk capacity for fuel, so they can't get huge orders, and so they're really in a tough. Yeah. Hoosley, a road won't, it won't necessarily help us with us actually using the road other than jobs or business, but Kobuk, Shungnak, and Ambler could really benefit from a road. And we're currently negotiating right now provisions where those communities will be able to use this road to help their villages. It's an industrial road only. It's not a public road. It's not going to be open. But we're making provisions where those communities that need it, they're going to be able to use to get fuel, building material, what have you. So a road like the Amler Road is really going to help out those villages. And Allakaket, too. Allakaket will have winter access and maybe even Hughes. But Hoosley is in a... We're surrounded by federal land, so we're pretty much... There's no way we could have access with a road. But we're good. We got barge service, so, yeah.
Thank you. Representative Elam?
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony and coming in and sharing with us. I guess one thing I would just say is work is good. It's good for your soul. And so I appreciate what you're saying. It really resonates. I see you have four communities. A couple of them, you know, median age of 23, 136 for population. Population of 80 with a median age of 70 years. Median age of, population of 177, but it doesn't say the median age. Are you looking – so it looks like you have four communities. Are you looking to incorporate all four of them into a single borough? And then what does your working age, you know, able-bodied population look like? What's your workforce look like?
Through the chair, Representative Elam. I think some of those statistics are misleading, but but we have a really good workforce, and especially if we were able to capture more revenue for workforce development, and we're able to provide jobs for our people, we have a lot of people that are working, but they have to migrate. They have to go to the North Slope, or they go to Fairbanks, or you know, there's some of them working on that, you know, that big storm they had in their business last. There's seven of them working there right now, and so we have the people that are willing and able to work. And we just got to figure out a way to provide them with opportunities.
Follow up.
You hit on a subject there. I hate seeing schools closed because it's usually an indicator that you don't have youth. You have to have youth if you're going to have that continued growth in a community. Do you have 20-something, 30-something adults?
Through the chair, Representative Vila, my village of Hoosley, that's what I meant when I said those statistics were misleading. I think it said we got 100 and something, but I think the population in my village is somewhere around 330 or something like that. In our school, there's 90 students in our school. I think there may be a few others, but Hoosley is the only village that's growing in interior Alaska that I know of. And I had a late friend, Wilmer Bedis, that he was a prominent leader from a village of Hughes, and he passed a couple of years ago. But He worked really hard because the village of Hughes was ready to close their school, and we were almost 10 students almost went down below. And he worked really hard to increase student enrollment. I think right now they got, the last I checked, they got 27 students in their school. But they were able to bring people back to their community. That's just what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to do too in other villages. Now, there's village Nulato and some other villages are asking us, how can we become involved in when we start talking about a borough? How can we become involved in that? And so at our next school board meetings on Thursday, this coming Thursday, on our agenda, we got a borough feasibility study that we're going to talk about. We already had the feasibility study done probably about 10 years ago, but it's been on the shelf. Now we're going to dust it back off, and we're going to start looking at it, and we're going to start moving forward.
One final follow-up?
Representative Elam.
Thank you. No, thank you. I appreciate that. And so I guess my final question would be is what kind of support do you need from us, from the state, or do you guys have this and you're just getting some public awareness?
Well, through the chair, Representative Elam, it's been a really difficult road. Like I said, we had to go through soul searching and everything. But it's critical that we have some type of economy in our area that'll sustain us, that'll carry us. And the only thing that we have is natural resource development, mining, in essence. We know of no oil or gas in our backyard or nothing, but we know there's an Ambler mining district, and there's a whole belt of proposed possible minerals that we can capitalize. So that's what we're looking at. That's what's going to determine if we can grow our communities and become stronger. And I know it's difficult, but I really feel we're up to the task.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Some of the communities that are in the slides are a part of an organized borough. They're with the Northwest Arctic Borough. Do you have further presentation?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Weifelt.
First of all, you did a great job. Fred did a great job. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Emil Adi. I'm here to voice support for the Ambler Road.
Oh, can we get a little bit closer to them?
I'm here to support the Ambler Road. I know the country up there. I was born in Keokuk. I know the people. They know my family. In 1941-42, we trapped up the Keokuk River. I've gone back. I've served in the meantime in the Navy and 5 years of college. But I do go back. I took a boat trip from Bettles, Allakaket, Alatna, Hughes, and Huslia. And one of the hard parts of the trip is when people come up to me and say they need a job. They're looking for work and still be able to stay in the village. They're concerned about the young people, younger people. They're concerned about their grandchildren. They have opportunities which mining would provide. If that mine lasts 40 or 50 years, there's an opportunity to build a career and retire, but still stay in the village. I took recently, been into, flew into Allakaket and Hughes and Huslia. And again, they looking for work. When I was Commissioner of Commerce, I served on the ADA board. And ADA, as you know, was chartered for financing risky projects that commercial banks won't touch. So ADA's been fulfilling that job of investing in development for jobs wherever they're needed, where capital is hard to come by. I've had the opportunity to watch Randy Ruaro. He's very knowledgeable. He works well with the villagers. They trust him. And I think he's doing a good job. When I listen to the people up there, the ones who support the road, and others, I'm sure, all agree that a restricted road is what they should have. That means no buses with tourists and no hunters. There's liability for them anyway, but that's possible. That's what they want to see in a contract to support the road. So I'll just say a few things. Recap here. I support the road. The people support it. And I agree with their desire to have a restricted industrial road with a limited access. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nadi. Are there any questions or comments? Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Nadi. I'm going to ask the same kind of general question that I asked Mr. Beifelt. Help me understand how attitude towards development have changed in your lifetime and your work in the state and on behalf of your neighbors. How have people changed or evolved their attitudes?
Well, it's becoming obvious. We all know that it's impossible to live in a village without some support. As a country, spend enormous amounts of money on money transfers for welfare. People don't want welfare. It's bad for the villages, and they know it. They'd like to get out of that, but they still like the lifestyle. They still want to hang on to the lifestyle of their parents and the traditions. So if we can find a way to provide jobs in the villages with the local development, those attitudes change slowly. But I think with what Fred said was right. The younger people are more willing to move to jobs, and they do move, but their attitudes are changing because even though a lot of people live in the cities, some of them still would like to go back. They still keep ties in the village. And no one wants to see the villages die. You drop below 10 kids and state quits supporting a school, and that's a death knell for the village.
Thank you. Follow-up?
If I may, and a follow-up, too, and help those of us from Anchorage or the other places in Alaska, what attitudes or cultural values or skills or experience in the land make the people of this region good partners to work with and working to build and operate this kind of transportation system?
Well, they come out of a system not too long ago where, when I was a child, people built their own homes, made their own clothing, built the tools they needed, sleds and snowshoes and caches, and put up fish for the winter, not only for the people but for the dog teams. All that's gone away. Game is less, with a lot more competition to make a living off the land. The king salmon is disappearing onto Yukon. Shut down. Kuskokwim shut down for king salmon. King salmon are catch and release in Kenai. So across the state, resources are becoming less and much more competition to make a living without having a job.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative, or co-chair Darby?
Yeah, through the co-chair, thank you, Mr. Nadi, for being here and for all of your work over all these years in Alaska, for Native people, for all Alaskans, and I guess while you're here, like I believe you've been through INCSA and ILCA. can you tell us one of, I don't even know how to word this, one of your best works or what have you seen that you're most proud of?
Well, I guess my involvement was when I was in the Navy, I was lived out across the state, United States, and 5 years in college. And there's still an attraction to a simpler life. And but in order to do that and build a retirement, you have to move to a city. So that's the attraction. I still have ties. I still go down to Yukon. I still hunt moose. And don't catch any more king salmon on the river. But does that answer your question?
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Noddy, for being here. And I believe we have one of your family members that are also here at the background.
My youngest son's back, John.
And staff to representative.
Raise your hand, Michael.
Following in your footsteps.
Yeah, thank you. Well, with that, I believe we are closing with Kent Sullivan and Calvin Good. So if you please join us at the presenter's table and put yourself on record and conclude your presentation.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Kent Sullivan. I'm general counsel for ADA, Sullivan, S-U-L-L-I-V-A-N. And I'm here with Kelvin Good from ADA as well, who's a project manager for ADA and has done a lot of work on the Ambler Road project. So thank you for having us this morning, or this afternoon, pardon me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I apologize, Mr. Raro had to step out for another obligation on behalf of the governor. And so we're going to just go through a few of the last slides and address things in closing here. And I think we've one of the things that hasn't been mentioned thus far, but a major aspect of the Ambler Road project is subsistence advisory committees. Obviously, one of the things that ADA is particularly interested in is making sure that a project like this does not impact subsistence. And so we've played a major role in helping to work with the Subsistence Advisory Committee that's shown here with its members and membership, and working with that committee to address various subsistence issues and how things need to be created and formed with regard to the Ambler Access Road project to avoid impacts to subsistence. And we're confident that the project will be able to do that and have minimal impacts to subsistence. Obviously, there's lots of issues around the road, including the fact that it's going to be private industrial access. And that's one of the ways that it's being designed to avoid impacts to subsistence. So there's lots of various aspects of the project that are focused on eliminating or reducing impacts to subsistence, and including through the use of the Subsistence Advisory Committee. Kelvin, anything on that you want to add?
No, you covered it really well. But we do reach out actively to the communities, and here shortly over the coming months, we've made a commitment to try and get out to all the communities that are going to be affected by the road or within proximity of the road at least quarterly, so that we can initiate that and continue that ongoing communication. But we've worked with the SAC committee over the last, I'm not sure how long, couple years?
Several years.
Yeah,
yep.
Sort of several years. And so their input's been invaluable in ensuring that how ADA goes about establishing its interactions and really the design around the permit process and the approval process of this road, but taking into consideration a lot of those who live from the region. So cultural, environmental, subsistence concerns, you know, these people have a voice. We're hearing them out, and we're trying to include what their concerns, what their comments are, into the overall process that we're undertaking for the road project.
Thank you. I believe we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly don't want to get too deeply into the subsistence issue, but I just, with the membership of the Subsistence Advisory Committee in front of us, just curious if there's any overlap between the membership of this and the state advisory councils for fish and game or for federal subsistence boards. Is there any overlap intersection of the membership of those boards that you can speak to?
That, I don't have that answer, but I can get that to you.
It'd just be good to know.
Okay.
Cooperation's happening.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
One of the things I would also point out, partially in response to Representative Sadler's comment through the co-chair, is that one of the other things that we're doing with the Ambler Access Road project is while ADA is sort of in the lead on this project, ADA's not doing this project alone. Not only are we working with the villages and communities in the area, but we're also working with many other partners and stakeholders with regard to this project, and those include some of the major mines that are currently in development. Those include both Nana and Doyon corporations, and what we're doing is we're creating a legal mechanism that all of those stakeholders, including Nana and Doyon and many of the village corporations, are going to have a say in how the road is managed, maintained, and controlled moving forward, how it's financed. All of those types of things are being done as a joint effort, and we've been having ongoing meetings for the past several months with all of those entities to basically put together the organizational legal structure for the road so that this is not just simply an ADA project run controlled by ADA from now until the end of time. That's not the way that it's being envisioned. This is very much a partnership with all the important stakeholders in the road, and that's undergoing right now. And again, the Subsistence Advisory Committee and the various villages are all going to have a major part in that.
Oh, Representative Elam.
Thank you. Just had a quick question for you. Where are we at in this process here? Because something I'm kind of struggling with a little bit is access restrictions. Mm-hmm. We have such limited access just in general across the state of Alaska. To limit access to a road that's being created just seems backwards to me.
Pardon me, Representative Elam through the co-chair. Certainly, access has been something that's coming up repeatedly throughout this project, and certainly access has been a concern for everyone involved. Obviously, it is a state entity, and although the long-term financing for the project is not going to come from ADA, it's going to come from all the stakeholders that are involved in the project and largely the users of the road, which will be the mining stakeholders. As I mentioned, one of the major considerations is subsistence, and that's probably one of the primary considerations for Nana and Doyon and many of the villages along the road. And should this project have been intended, like the West of Sitna project, as a public road, it would not have moved forward. It would not have been possible. It would not have been able to be done. And that is because Nana and Doyon are key and critical in this project. This road goes through a large portion of each of their lands. And so in order to respect that and honor that and address their sovereignty and their concerns, it was important from the very get-go that this road not be a road that the public had access to so that the public could go into these areas along the road and impact subsistence uses. And so, unfortunately, this project could not have moved forward with it being a public road. And so that's one of the trade-offs that had to occur early on in this project, and that's one of the things that we're honoring and moving forward with the project.
If I may follow up?
Follow up.
So who owns the road?
So the road is going to be, right now the permits are in Ada's name, but moving forward, that's still a discussion point in this legal mechanism that's being created for ownership, control, financing, management of the road. It's going to be this entity. And exactly who will own what, whether various stakeholders will own individual pieces, whether it'll be owned by the entity, whether it'll be held by Ada but leased to the entity, those are all things that are still under consideration and still being looked at.
One more follow-up?
Then thank Representative you. Souther.
It sounds like a lot of this is already kind of moved forward, but again, it's just I struggle with access because, you know, I live on the Kenai Peninsula and we have tens of thousands of acres of land that we can't access that has roads on it, and you can kind of walk on it, but you can't do anything on it, and it's public lands. And so does this road go through public lands or is it all private land?
Representative Elam, through the co-chair, it goes through private land, it goes through state public land, and it goes through federal public land. And so there's a wide variety of ownership interests that the road passes through, and it makes it very, very complicated from a access creation standpoint and what's done in the future and what parties need to involve in order to make the project successful. But again, that's where this project is contrasted significantly with, for instance, West Susitna. A primary purpose of the West Susitna project is for public access, is for access to fish and wildlife resources by the public, particularly with it being so close to the Anchorage area. So it's just that project, it wasn't necessary to have complete buy-in by ANCSA corporations because the land ownership in that area was very different. And so, but with regard to the Ambler Access Project, having the full cooperation of Doyon and NANA was critical, or else the project simply wouldn't have moved forward. And so we had to respect their wishes with regard to this project.
Thank you. Just one final statement, if I may.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. I struggle, and I don't think that public access should be limited on public lands. And I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Souther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got one question, and I'll hold some of the others for later, but I want to give you the opportunity to you know, we frequently hear questions like, or people say things, maybe it's a little bit cynically, yeah, they say it's going to be, you know, closed to the public, but so is the Hall Road. What do you answer to them? I anticipate maybe the Long Mountain system, the road might be an answer, but I'm sure that's a question you get over and over again. What is the answer you provide to those that say, ultimately, this cannot be held as a private road, ultimately it's going to be expanded to provide access to tourists, hunters, you know, visitors, looky-loos?
Representative Sadler, through the co-chair, it's very different than the Dalton in that the Dalton essentially started out as a public road with restricted access. So it's possible to have a public roadway, and there's Alaska case law that says that it's possible to have a public roadway where you can actually restrict or prevent the public from accessing due to various issues, whether it be resource issues, trespass issues, resource damage issues, all sorts of different things. The Alaska Supreme Court says that you can restrict public access on a public road in order to take into account various other considerations. And so that there is precedent for that. In this instance, there are steps being taken so that that can not occur at all. There, for instance, one of the things that's going to be done with regard to the Ambler Access Project is there's going to be a security gate at the entrance to the road, likely manned full time. There's going to be security measures in place to ensure that the public does not have access to the road itself. Again, with regard to the question from Representative Elam, it's there's no intent here to block access to public lands, generally speaking, in the area other than the road itself and for a certain area around the road. So it's the road corridor that's going to be industrial private access, but it's not going to be all state lands anywhere within the vicinity of the road. But that being said, those lands will be very difficult to access without using a road. So, but there will be steps taken to ensure that this road is, as long as it's utilized as a road, as the Ambler Access Road, and before it's ultimately decommissioned, if that ever occurs, that only the parties, the stakeholders, and the parties that are members of this entity will have the ability to use it.
To put a fine point in that, through the chair, Mr. Sullivan, you said that the Dalton Highway was a public road with restrictions. Is that the same model? Would the Ambler Road be a public road with restrictions to protect resources, or would it have some other different legal structure?
No, it's going to be a private industrial access road, period. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Just doing a time check. We've got about 20 minutes and several more slides if we want to continue with the presentation.
You bet.
Okay, so workforce development. So this is a slide that's, we've also been working with several folks throughout the region regarding workforce development, and it's part of our stakeholder engagement requirements. We're expecting to create thousands of jobs over the years once the mines are up and running. When the roadway does begin to get built, you're looking at like roundly 500 people is what it would take to construct the road. But over the course of the mine's life expectancy, we're looking at thousands of jobs over the years, just in mining alone. That doesn't include all the tertiary jobs associated with that. For instance, export. I don't think that we're taking into account export here, but there's a. We've also begun talking to these communities about getting able-bodied lists of people. So how many folks, like we met with folks in Hooslea, and I've been with Ada for about 3 months, and there's several communities that we're going to be meeting with in the coming months. One of the recommendations that I have to them is put together a talent bank, because in the coming years we're going to be having a lot of job opportunities, and the more structured that folks are in having a usable talent bank for those that are looking to find able-bodied workers is going to be that much more, I'd say, easy and economical for folks in the region to find long-term work. And so that's a position that Ada is taking in helping develop the region, along with this roadway. We're advising them in that capacity. Next slide.
Representative Souther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for interrupting. In the time we have available, I'm just going to say that the presentation so far has been pretty good on making the case and citing the benefits. And as I look ahead in the slides, I see more information about that. I would like to, if we can, save time in the presentation to ask questions. There's been a lot of legal and political roadblocks thrown in the Ambler Road project's way. I'd like to have the chance to explore some of those. I gotta say, this is good information. It's available to us, but it'd be nice to have some dialogue about some of those more current and pressing, you know, critical issues. Please.
Absolutely. Representative Souther, are we... Well, I suppose... Can we go through the slides? And
certainly
try to leave some time at the
co-chair,
end.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely happy to do that. And this slide, very quickly, obviously one of the things that Ada is doing is we've had a very successful project with the DeLong Mountain Transportation System that's being used as a model, if you will, for the Ambler Access Road. Because it's been so successful, because it's contributed so much money to the state and to the economy and to jobs in the region, we're really looking to Red Dog and the DeLong Mountain Transportation System as a model to follow with regard to the Ambler Access Road. There's some critical differences in that, obviously, the DeLong Mountain Transportation System is a much shorter road. It involves one resource development stakeholder and one regional Native corporation. So it's far simpler than the Ambler Access Project, but similar in other ways in that it's going to be the mining stakeholder who is basically paying for use of the road over time. And that's similar to what's going to be done with the Ambler Access Project as well. And again, here's again to Representative Sadler's point, the Ambler Access Project was actually provided for in ANILCA and mandated that there shall be access to the Ambler Mining District through the federal conservation system units that are along the Ambler Mining District. And so, again, back to Representative Sadler's question, one of the roadblocks that we had run into originally when we went through the NEPA process with initially the Trump administration and then subsequently the Biden administration is there was a reluctance of the Biden administration to actually take into account that there was already a federal statute, ANILCA, or federal act, pardon me, ANILCA, that mandated that access shall occur through those federal conservation system units. And so that's one of the reasons why the Biden administration came out with the no-action alternative and said that the impacts caused by the road are going to be too great and therefore it should not be allowed. It didn't take into account explicit provisions within ANILCA that already many, many, many years before mandated that access occur. And so one of the things that ADA did this past spring was we filed an appeal under ANILCA, under Section 1106 of ANILCA with President Trump on June 6th, basically appealing that no-action alternative where the decision was made that the road project should not move forward. And as we now know, on October 6th of 2025, President Trump granted that appeal and mandated that the permits, all federal permits for the road, shall be issued. And under 1106 of ANILCA, that decision is non-appealable. And so the project has been rapidly moving forward since that time. And so that's sort of a brief snapshot, if you will, Representative Sadler, of sort of the legal background for getting us to the point that we are today with regard to the project.
Representative Sadler?
And one question is, ADA appealed to what jurisdictional body exactly? And I hope we get into any Native corporation land ownership issues as well next.
Representative Sadler, through the co-chair, ADA appealed directly to the President of the United States, which is the only time that I'm aware of that that's happened from an administrative agency to the President. But the reason that was allowed is because it's an explicit provision within Section 1106 of ANILCA. So ANILCA, with the creators of ANILCA and the folks that had the foresight to draft that act, they anticipated that there would be situations in the future where perhaps an administrative agency declined to follow the provisions of the act, and therefore they allowed a direct appeal of that to the President of the United States, and that's the option that ADA took this past spring, and that's what is now allowing the project to move forward.
There's so many nuggets buried in ANILCA. Thank you.
It has been long ignored,
yeah.
Fortunately, there's still a few people around that understand what all the provisions provide for and how important they are to Alaska. And this slide here shows the project, and it shows the ownership, land ownership of the project. And if you can see off to the far right on this image in yellow, you'll see the Dalton that is in black, and then just before Wiseman or south of Wiseman, roughly 20 miles or 10 miles south of Coldfoot in that vicinity, is where the Ambler Access Road takes off from the Dalton. It initially goes through about 18 or 20 miles of BLM ground. That land is currently part of PLO 5150, which is a federal land withdrawal that was made for construction of the Dalton Highway. It was intended to be temporary, but when that was done way back in the early, in 1971, it's never been lifted. And as a result of that, there's been several million acres that have been tied up in PLO 5150, despite the Dalton being built, despite it being used for all these years. It had never been lifted. That withdrawal had never been lifted. So it basically created a situation where the state of Alaska had went in and done a bunch of land selections at time of statehood to select lands within that area, knowing that someday PLO 5150 should legally be released and lifted, but that had never occurred. And so that first 20 miles of the road was actually on BLM-managed land, but it was not on land that BLM owned because, again, state of Alaska had top-filed on it. Just recently, here within the past 10 days, I believe, it was announced that BLM is finally lifting PLO 5150. And that is going to begin to take place within 30 days of when it was announced, roughly 10 days ago. And we should start seeing those transfers occur late this summer. And so that entire area, much of the area that you see in yellow there, including at the entrance to the Ambler Road, will ultimately vest in the Department of Natural Resources. And so then past that, you'll see the areas in purple. The areas in purple right there are Doyon lands, and then you have state land, again, DNR land after that, and you have Gates of the Arctic lands in the light purple that are next. And then you go over and there's more state land, and then you get into Nana land and the bornite mine that Nana has and that area over there. So that shows you sort of the complex land ownership. As you can see, the mining claims, there's both state and federal mining claims there in the crosshatch areas, and there are literally thousands of mining claims in the Ambler Mining District. And the hope is that obviously, you know, there's been a lot of exploration in that area for the last 100 years. There's lots and lots and lots of known mineral deposits, including lots of copper, a fair amount of rare earth mineralization. But the hope is that once this road is constructed, not only will the mines that currently know the resources they have be able to get permits, come into development and creation, but in addition, new mines that where there's been all these claims that haven't been fully explored because they haven't had easy access will soon be able to become explored and will be able to come into operation. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot more that will come out of this project in the near future than I think we even currently realize.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hear the clock a ticking, and I wanted to try and get a question answered about, I understand, and these gentlemen will probably remember much clearer, more clearly than I do, that there had been efforts from some Native-based organizations, possibly regional corporations, possibly other NGOs who have resisted the Ambler Road and have withdrawn permission to cross the road, for the road to cross the land. I'd like to ask the status of those, if resolved or not, and if there are any more expected on the horizon.
Representative Sadler, through the co-chair, yes, there's been, as most everyone here knows, there's been various support and lack of support and change of positions over the last few years involving the Ambler Access Project. And, you know, clearly it's a controversial project, and there's many who support it, and there's many who don't support it, including the regional corporations at times, both Nana and Doyon have either been on the fence with things or been opposed to things at times and also been supportive at times. And again, the villages have had sometimes different positions than the regional corporations. But as I mentioned, right now, we're in ongoing discussions, very positive and productive discussions with both of the regional corporations, who are both very, very open to considering things. I can't represent that they're both 100% in support of the road, or even I can't even say in support of the road necessarily. But they're open to looking at it and considering it and contributing to this legal organization and what might be put in place to make the road a reality. And that's very important to my understanding from Nana and Dalton's perspective, because until we get this entity formed and created, that's what's going to really dictate what the project looks like moving forward for each of those entities and their shareholders and their villages on the ground from here on out. And so I understand the reluctance by those entities to necessarily say yay or nay as to the project, because it's going to be these discussions that are occurring right now. We had very productive discussions last week and a few weeks before that in the last couple of months. So things are happening and happening very rapidly.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Co-Chair Dibert.
Thank you through the co-chair. Thank you for your presentation, and I love this map. I have a question about along the road, the dark green offshoots. It looks like Inukuk Lake, and then at number four, there's a dark green offshoot upper river. Can you tell more about those? If it looks like they're roads, but I'm not sure. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Dibert, are you you're talking about Inukuk Lake green offshoots?
From the road,
those are rivers.
Yeah, so we've got.
Are you talking about this area?
Yeah.
That area?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I think those potentially might be additional water bodies. I know that there's squares. Those are, I think, native allotments. These are native allotments. But the only green offshoots that I can see that might be property related would be off of the Dalton. But I think those might be water bodies. If we're looking at the same thing, we're looking at a smaller map right here, so it's difficult for me to identify.
Thank you, Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. It looks like we've got more questions. Ultimately, I'd like to know more about the business plan, construction plan timelines. But for today, are you able to share what the current construction cost estimates are?
Representative Mears, through the co-chair, can't right now. The numbers are varying at this point. I believe they're as low as roughly $700 million and maybe slightly more than that. One of the things that ADA is doing right now is we're currently letting out a contract for 2026 field work that will include geotech for the bridges. There's roughly 13 major stream crossings along the roadway, and obviously the bridges are going to be a major expense for the road. And so we're trying to perform the geotech work and also the work for material sites and for helicopter landing zones. And the hope is that at the conclusion of this calendar year, we should be in a much better place to have a more refined and definitive estimate on the exact cost of the road. So that's what we're working on right now. But right now, all we have are fairly broad estimates. And I think the low end of the estimate is $700 million, and the high end may be slightly over $1 billion.
Follow up?
Just quickly, I wanted to note that I believe in the ADA budget there is $200 to $250 million set aside for the Ambler Road project for the next fiscal year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mears, through the co-chair, that may well be correct, but again, ADA is not looking at necessarily constructing the road with all of its own funds. We're, again, working with stakeholders and other parties on, as well as the federal government, with grants and various things. There's all sorts of aspects that are going into the actual construction of the road and paying for construction of the road. So there are monies set aside for the Ambler Access Project, but that's not necessarily just construction.
Can I clarify that?
Sure, Representative.
Thank you, through the chair. I wasn't implying that I thought that that would be the entire construction cost for the project.
Oh, understood.
Thank you. And it looks like we're at time, so maybe in the near future we can either have you back before us, or if there are further questions, if you want to draft them and send them to my office, we can get it and then distribute it to committee members. Representative Sadler, I saw your... Well, and so I just want to say thank you. We are past time, and there is another committee coming in here shortly, so we've got to vacate the room. So thank you, Mr. Sullivan, Mr. Good. Thank you, Mr. Lampe, Mr. Beifeld, and Mr. Noddy as well for being here. That completes the agenda for our House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting is Wednesday, March 4th, 2026, where the committee will hold a second hearing on House Bill 208 from Representative Mears relating to LNG import facilities, and then an initial hearing on House Bill 321 from Representative Josephson relating to fish and game wildlife refuges. The time now is 3:02 p.m., and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.